Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW, Washington.
Watch and comment for Tuesday, January 21st. I'm Dave Rabin. It's great to be with you, joining you from Italia, from Italy, through the wonders of modern technology. It's great to be with you with the able assistance of our dear engineer, Mike Nocella. And coming up, we'll speak with the father of a student slain at Parkland High School in Florida, along with 16 others. The father has channeled his grief into guac, his one-man show at DC's Woolly Mammoth Theater, coming up starting January 25th. But first, a big subject, a daunting subject that has been daunting for a long time. Money has been the mother's milk of U.S. politics for a long time. As turn of the 20th century, wealthy businessman and U.S. Senator Mark Hanna said, quote, "There are two things that are important in politics. The first is money, and I can't remember what the second one is." But the Citizens United case, which has its 15th birthday today, so it's a very timely show, created a dynamic where big donors now wield more political power than ever before. And the threat to democracy is clearly dire. As former Justice Louis Brandeis warned, quote, "We must make our choice. We may have democracy or we may have wealth concentrated in the hands of few, but we cannot have both." I mean, I remember when I first read that quote, I just like, wow, that's an important analysis and important to keep in mind. And joining us to talk about these dire times is Common Cause President Virginia K. Solomon and Open Secrets Director of Insights, Brendan Glavin. Welcome to you both. It's great having you.
Great to be here. Thank you so much, David.
Yes, thank you.
I really appreciate you joining us and really appreciate all that you're doing. And we welcome callers. This is Community Watch and Comment. We need your comments, your questions, your thoughts. 202-588-0893. My engineer will let me know that you're on hold, that we're going to talk with our guests for a bit, but please do chime in. We want to hear from you. So 2024 is just an extraordinary election, absurdly wealthy people thrusting themselves into political power. Elon Musk didn't just donate $250 million. He was running whole elements of Trump's campaign, which was relatively skeletal, I think we can say. You got, in addition to Musk, the likes of Miriam Edelman, casino owner David Sachs. And I'm going to just throw these questions out, and I think you probably both have comments on all of these comments, these questions. What do you all think? Virginia K. Solomon, your thoughts on the election that just occurred and the inauguration yesterday?
So much to unpack. I mean, and I'm sure Brendan will have a lot to say as well. I think what we saw on full display was an oligarchy that has now taken form in America. You see the richest, the wealthiest front and center on stage, and not just in the audience, but behind now President Trump.
Yes.
Those were the people who had his back. The optics alone, I think, were really very, very telling for us. And the amount of money that was donated, whether it was through the election, through super PACs, or to the inauguration fund, I think it, and Brendan, you probably have better data than I do at this point, but there was, you know, people sitting on stage who were basically combined over $1 trillion in net worth. These are the people who are influencing policy in our country. I was talking to some of our staff yesterday, and, you know, because everyday folks sometimes aren't paying as close of attention. I think it's just not your job to have to do it the way that we do. But the way I described it is that the oligarchy no longer has a veil over it. It's not hidden in the background. You know, you want to give a Harry Potter analogy. It's not that that cloak, the invisibility cloak, is no longer there. And so I think it was also an announcement that we're for sale. I found it very, very interesting that it was so many of the people from the tech industry in particular. And that was one of the things that really stood out to me. It was a symbol that this was the end of regulation as we know it, especially when it comes to media, social media, the information that we consume. Everybody's familiar with what blood diamonds are, right? And so I think of it as, you know, the diamond mind. We are the blood diamonds now. And what I mean by that is these very, very wealthy people own the minds, which is our intellectual property, our information, the algorithms about the things that we consume. They now have the ability to control what we purchase, the information that we consume, the news that we consume, our politics, all through an algorithm, because we have given over this data to them. And now they are using it to manipulate us. And so I hate the way it sounds to me, because it's almost like conspiracy theorist, but this is the reality of where we are in this country, that a few wealthy individuals and corporations now control so much, and they are standing behind Donald Trump because this will allow them to enrich themselves even further.
Yeah. Brendan McLavin from Open Secrets, your thoughts?
Yeah, so there's also a lot to jump to. I will say you really hit on a couple right important things when you, in your intro there. And, you know, going back to that old quote, and so, right, money has always been this, it's always been there. It's a part of our system. And obviously, you know, you can't run for office without some money, right? You have to be able to run ads. You have to be able to even at a local level, you got to be able to buy signs and things like that. You can get your name out. But, right, what we've seen, the change in the dynamic after 2010 and Citizens United and this follow-up case Speech Now, this change in dynamic of all the money flowing in from these outside groups. We have the super PACs now. We have nonprofits spending. And we see, like, from a numbers perspective, we look like if you go back to the presidential election in 2008, we see about 13 times more money spent by these outside groups. And that's all from these mega donors. So each cycle.
Could we repeat that? 13 times the amount of money we spent now from 2008. I mean, that's a little bit more than inflation.
Right. And political spending rises more than inflation of itself. But that is just, this is just at a whole nother level. So this, all this increasing money we've seen, and, you know, in the last, you know, 15, 16 years, and it's really driven by these mega donors getting in and just, more and more each cycle. And then, you know, Musk just took it to a different level this year. As you said, he, in your sort of traditional mega donor, you know, likes to give money, more of a Mellon type, right? Timothy Mellon was a big donor this year. He gives the money and he lets other people, you know, take care of spending the money, and he stays in the background. And that's more of that sort of traditional model. But Musk is, right, came out, he gave the money, started his own super PAC, was very active in making, how was the money being spent in the super PAC? Then he inserted his own personality, his own persona into the election, went to rallies, held his own rallies. And that was a very sort of a change in that. And now we have this position where he is right there with Trump, right next to him, and to the point where, right, there's people are making memes and calling him the real president or the co-president and things. Right. And that's kind of this, odd situation that we've, created.
Yeah, I mean, as you're saying, it isn't just Musk. Brennan Center has a new study out. 44% of Trump's money came from 10 donors. 44% of the money came from, Louis Brandeis is turning over several times in his grave. I mean, it would be comical if it wasn't so frightening. And of course, Musk is a contractor, was it SpaceX? And all sorts of things going on in terms of manipulating the federal government to his will, to his ends. And it's only going to increase with this DOGE, Department of Government Efficiency, he's going to be heading up with a colleague. It's amazing. And of course, it's perhaps unfortunate that Biden didn't talk about it sooner than his farewell speech, but he's talking about oligarchy. It can only remind one of Eisenhower's farewell speech, the military-industrial complex, which was supposed to include the military-industrial congressional complex, but his aides got him to take it out. But you guys are too young to remember that, perhaps. he kind of had the nail on the head, and Jimmy Carter talked about it too. Let's talk about what the birthday girl, if you will, today, Citizens United. Brendan, what's your elevator speech on Citizens United and what it meant for campaign finance in this country?
It's just, as I alluded to, it's just, or I was pretty, upfront about it, right? That this post Citizens United and in speech now, which then allowed the creation of the super PACs, aside from just this increase in money, it's, how is that happening? One of the pieces of that is super PACs have created a vehicle for a lot of dark money, where we're talking about the stuff that we know right now. You're talking about the people that we know about, but there's also the people who are putting money in the system that we don't know who they are. And now we have Citizens United really created in the creation of super PACs, allowed this situation where nonprofits, C4s, can give money to super PACs, and then the super PACs are spending the money on elections. Super PACs have to disclose their donors, but if the donor is a C4, then we don't know where that money came from, really. And that's where we get the term dark money. We don't, and so certainly there's a lot of that going on as well. And so that's, I guess, a whole nother discussion of the part that we don't know about. But so that's part of the issue there, but it's created the super PACs, and it's just a great, I don't mean to say it's great in a good way, but from the point of view of a mega donor, it makes it very easy for them. I can give the money to the super PAC, they can handle it, they can spend the money, and it gives me, even though it's disclosed that I gave the money, there's a degree of, a separation there. And also sometimes you can give the money to one super PAC and then the super PAC gives it to another super PAC and then they're spending the money. And that creates a little more separation from the donor. And because, Virginia said earlier, your average citizen is only paying attention, right, so much. They're worrying about going out and doing their job and buying their groceries and that sort of thing. And so... even though it's easy for me because this is what I do and look and I can connect the dots very easily, it's harder for regular people to do that. And then we have to rely on, you know, third parties to get the word out on what's going on.
Right. So Virginia Case, Solomon of Common Cause, we didn't have the term dark money before Citizens United, if I'm understanding correctly.
No, I mean, and this is a kind of a more recent phenomenon. If you think about, you know, just the past 15 years and how the floodgates have really opened, you know, as Brendan said earlier, you know, 13 times this amount of spending and investment that's going on. And I would add, just to back up a little bit, because I know we were talking about Elon Musk, that doesn't include what I would consider the in-kind money that will resources that would never be tracked, right? The manipulation of the algorithm of X by owning X platform, which is a major social media outlet with worldwide reach. It has the ability to support a candidate indirectly, right? When you think about the owners of some of these platforms who stopped combating mis and disinformation and just put an end to it, that actually helped to move the narrative forward for Donald Trump in this particular election and future elections, right? It may be somebody different. So there is, I think the idea of dark money is actually even evolving beyond what we're talking about with just a cash donation, with this concentration of wealth and investment that's happening. I think the other thing that we have to be able to name, though, is that while the average American is not digging in, and because who has time, right? Like Brendan and I do this for work. So the average person isn't spending all of their time digging in.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that there's a problem. They saw it. Now, some people, I will say, half the country think this is great. These are billionaires and they're smart and they wouldn't be so rich if they weren't so smart. Maybe we should be listening to them. And then there's a whole other half of the country who are saying, wait a second, I'm struggling to put food on my table. I'm struggling to be able to pay rent. I can't afford to buy a home. How is it that these people have more of a voice in our politics than I do? And so what it comes down to at the core of it, I think, is that there is just a disproportionate amount of wealth. And I'm not anti-wealth, I'm anti-poverty. I want to make that really clear. But I think it's how people's money gives them a greater voice than the average person in this country. And that is what is at the root of it, is that money should not have a voice in this country. That person, Elon Musk, should not have a greater voice than I do, or that you do, or anybody listening on this call right now does. Because at the end of the day, it's supposed to be one person, one vote.
Yep.
And people, and if money is dictating that now, if it's $1, one vote, we have a big problem.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, we go back to Louis Brandeis, Justice Brandeis, the great, Franklin Delano Roosevelt appointed judge who said, you got to choose, are you going to have concentration of wealth, or are you going to have democracy? And, you know, we're going to have concentration of wealth, but by God, we better be able to regulate it. And that it's falling apart. I mean, Citizens United said, oh, it'll be fine. We're going to, you know, the donors, the campaigns will be independent from the donors and there'll be full disclosure. It's not, it has not panned out. It has not worked. And we should point out, we're talking about Trump at all. This is a bipartisan problem. I think David Brooks pointed out, he says, most billionaires in this country are Democrats. You know, I think Kamala Harris took in more money than Trump actually did, if I'm not mistaken. So if Brendan Glavin, what do you think? I mean, that this is not just a question of you know, Trump running over the boundaries. It's the whole system, if you will.
Certainly a bipartisan issue as far as, because So I said, you know, the campaigns need money, and you can't, and you know, if one side is taking advantage of the rules as they are, you know, the other side can't just lay down and say, well, we're not going to do that. That's not going to work out too well for them. Of course, yeah, the Harris campaign did raise a lot more than when you look at the campaigns themselves. You know, the Harris campaign raised a lot more, but then the Trump campaign, although they did very well with, you know, small donations, people who are giving in, you know, smaller amounts, raised hundreds of millions of dollars from people who are giving in, you know, $50, $100 and, you know, that sort of thing. But then the Super PAC supporting Harris, the Future Forward, you know, I mentioned the dark money. It was you know, quite a bit of dark money flowing into that Super PAC. So there were clearly mega donors funneling money in on that side, but we don't necessarily know who they are, or I say who could be an organization. We're not, you know, we're not sure. But if you go back and you look at 2020, it was a little bit of the opposite, as far as, you know, who was spending more on from, who was raising more from mega donors and that sort of thing. It's it comes and goes, but it's clearly, you know, both sides, you have to take advantage of the rules as they are, which is, you know, creates a problematic part.
Common Causes, Virginia K. Solomon, your thoughts on the bipartisan nature of the problem?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we like to say is that it's not about right and left, it's about right and wrong. And ultimately, the way that the system has been set up as a result of this ruling is that it's rendered both parties unable to win an election without those resources. Because imagine, there are people who have pledged not to take that money, not to take big super PAC money, and who have said, I'm not going to participate in this. And what's happened is it's damn near impossible to win a race at this point without some kind of an investment. And so there's this catch 22 for political, for elected officials, where if you don't take any money, you're going to be outspent, and the likelihood of you being able to win, even with the best of intentions, kind of goes away. And so I think one of the things that we need to look at is what are some opportunities for solutions. And at the state and local level, we've seen a lot of campaign finance reform that has been passed. It has helped. It has created more of an even playing field for folks when we think about small dollar donors and things like that. Matching funds, there's a lot of ways that we can still. At the federal level, there has been a lack of will and desire to engage in legislative solutions that will help that. Now, I will say there are some really great people at the federal level as well who have tried to do things to take some of these, to create some solutions. And there are some political leaders who have been working really hard. I know, you know, even with the disclosure, if we can't get rid of it, how do we make sure that people know? And so, for example, Senator Klobuchar has been focusing on something called the Disclose Act for a really long time. There has been with the Freedom to Vote Act, which has been kind of HR 1 in the House for the past couple of Congresses, though also some solutions around campaign finance, but it doesn't go far enough. And obviously there is a filibuster in the Senate, which has prevented a lot of this legislation from going through. But you have people like Sheldon Whitehouse and others who really, really do. And obviously Senator Sanders, who has been preaching the gospel on this for a really long time. So it's not as though there is not a universal will. I think there is will. I think the way forward is the biggest challenge, because it will upend the way that campaigns are run. I mean, you have a 15-year history now, right? And it's just continued to grow. And so there is both a problem, but how do you back out of that? And what is the appropriate solution is the big question mark.
Right. We're going to get to possible solutions towards the end of our time together. I should say I'm speaking with the Common Cause President Virginia K. Solomon and Open Secrets Director of Insights of Brendan Glavin. And I want to talk about the fear of politicians, even if money isn't spent. You mentioned Rhode Island Senator Sheldon White, Whitehouse, who said, once people know that you can spend the money and that you're willing to spend the money, then your threat to spend the money is as convincing as actually spending it. And I think arguably we're seeing what happened in the last week playing out with this dynamic. I mean, Joni Ernst, Senator of Iowa, was, you know, making a lot of noise questioning the nominee for the Defense Secretary, Hegseth. And then all of a sudden she's on board, and there was $1 million campaign in Iowa targeting her. And, you know, the whole, what is, I think it's a relatively new verb, you know, getting primaried. And it very well, we don't know for sure, but it very well might have swung her to not making too much noise about Hegseth. And Lord knows she had plenty of reason to make some noise, being what, sexually abused in her time in the military, and Hegseth with all his allegations. And, you know, as we've noted on the show, you know, Hegseth has a whole underbelly of religious affiliations that are really questionable. I don't believe it was even touched on, which is arguably more scary than the other accusations against him. You know, why is that? So I guess my broad question is, what about the, you know, the fear of what happened to you if you don't toe the line, which isn't necessarily going to be shown in how much money was spent, you know, how much money was donated. Your thoughts, whoever wants to speak,
you know,
up.
It's like you said, sometimes it's the money doesn't have to be spent. And, you know, in this case, you're talking about the money that was spent, but there's two things. One, it goes back to, people always want to, you want to see, try to see what's the quid pro quo. Like, you know, we got the money, and then later on, did they, you know, vote for, something in favor of the donor? But of course, a lot of times, you know, if things can get, you never get to that point. So something can get killed in a committee or not even brought up, and because it was killed before that. And then there's really no record of the action that was taken. And so these things kind of, right, can happen behind closed doors, where just the threat is enough. And but it's also, the other thing is, with the super PACs in the past, right, primarying has always been a thing. There's always that threat of like, oh, we're going to primary you. Well, now you can have, it's much easier for, they can have a big donor come in, give some money, and they can start attacking that incumbent right away. It could be a nonprofit could come in, C4 could come in and start spending money, or super PAC. And so it really amps up the ability of these outside groups and their access to money very quickly, ramps up that threat where they can come in right away. And, you know, you start seeing it more and more. There's a lot more of ads being run very early in the cycle. They're acting as issue ads, where they're like, you know, call, you know, Senator so-and-so and tell them that they're wrong, or they need to be on this place on this issue, or they're wrong on this. And those are the, you know, beginnings of the campaign attacks. And it's, right, it's a lot easier to for those things to come up now.
Yeah. Virginia K. Solomon, your thoughts on how the threats operate. And I guess one question that occurs to me is, you know, has this been amped up since Citizens United? I mean, the ability to just throw $1 million against Joni Ernst real fast in Iowa and scare her off of questioning Hegseth. Your thoughts about the overall picture, but particularly, you know, whether Citizens United has opened up this avenue of attack to a greater degree.
Oh, I mean, I think it absolutely has opened it up to a greater degree, especially again because of something Brendan was mentioning earlier, is that the ability to move money around, sometimes it becomes the shell game. So you don't even always necessarily know, right? You can move from one super PAC to another. It becomes less clear who's even doing it, which kind of makes it more challenging. I think one of the things that we also have to be reminded of, though, is that people are always expected to toe the line, right, for your party. People, you know, by and large, there have been few, the quote unquote mavericks have been few and far between. They're not everybody had the courage of a John McCain, nor does everybody always have the stature or the visibility of a John McCain, who was very much revered and beloved because he was an American hero. On both sides, people really did admire and respect him, even if they did not agree with all of his decisions. John McCain, if you recall back during the Obamacare, when they were trying to overturn that, and you know his famous thumbs down, I can't imagine it, like the times have shifted, right? So it's much more difficult. He was a much more strong personality. He was somebody who showed up differently in the space and was not afraid to be courageous. And I think that there is another combination, not only this, but when you have people who lack courage, moral courage, to make the right decision, to make the right choice. Combine that with a decision like Citizens United, and we're in big trouble. And I think that's something that we have to continue to remind ourselves of. It is not just about the money. The money is a symptom of a larger problem, but it is one that has greatly accelerated where we are heading in this country when it comes to our ability to govern with the same focus or the same priorities as a country, which is to make sure that all of the people are benefiting from these decisions, not just a few wealthy individuals.
I should say we'd love to hear from callers 202-588-0893. Any thoughts, comments, questions? We'd really like to hear from you. 202-588-0893. Let's get down to the nitty-gritty, some specifics. What's all this big spending mean for non-white people? I mean, needless to say, you've got these three figureheads up on the dais with Trump yesterday, with Zuckerberg and Bezos and Musk. And gee, wait a minute, those are three white guys. I mean, the rich people, by and large, are disproportionately white. And what does that mean for non-white people in terms of what kind of policies get enacted? Brendan, any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think it's a pretty basic thing, and it's you see it's related to just like Meta pulling back on their DEI stuff. So and there's it's pretty basic stuff. Those you see those people up there, the donors are not representative of the people. And it's hard to see how you're going to get diverse points of view out of that.
Any thoughts on that, Virginia?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately at the end of the day, it's people of color, black and brown people who are usually most disproportionately harmed by a lot of these policies. And that has held true throughout the history of this country. When you think about the concentration of wealth among a certain few, many people, especially black and brown people, have always been left behind. And until we come to a reckoning in this country, you know, there is no such thing as colorblindness when you see the disproportionate concentration of wealth. It is not hard to see and connect those dots and see that through line. And not to say that all Black and brown people are poor, right? Like, the, you know, your experience in this country is 360 degrees. But what I'm talking about is that top 1% or that top 10% of people in this country who own the wealth and have the greatest voice as a result of the Citizens United decision. And their experience is not backed in any sort of reality from the regular person, certainly somebody who has been harmed by systems of inequality, whether it's wealth inequality, whether it's class inequality, or whether it's just the kind of harm that has come and been inflicted upon people for centuries as a result of racism. So it is real, and it is both heartbreaking, but also I think motivating. And I think it's also ironic, you know, yesterday was Dr. King's day, and he talked about the wealth inequality. He talked about moderates in this country. He talked about the issues that he talked about with wealth can't be forgotten in his legacies. It was in his legacy. He's not only about having a dream, it was about making sure that we had an economic system in this country that was level and fair and just.
Yes. Yep. Last 2 years of his life were very much dedicated to that. That's why he was in Memphis. We have a couple of callers and we're running out of time, so I really want to get to them. First caller, thank you so much for checking in. Your name, if you care to, and where you're from, and your question or comment.
Citizens United, aren't unlimited campaign expenditures supposed to be independent, a candidate's campaign? And how can Musk be independent when he's right there next to Trump, as Brendan Glavin said earlier? Is it a deadlock federal election commission that's not enforcing, or what?
If you want to take that, Brendan, I can stream like this and get one voice per question, just because we're running out of time.
Sure. I mean, technically these outside groups like America PAC that Musk founded are supposed to operate independently of campaigns. One, the enforcement of this, you know, in the right, the technical term is coordination. The enforcement of the coordination rule, you know, many have criticized the Federal Election Commission over the years for lax enforcement of the coordination rule. Plus, this past year, the FEC gave a, advisory opinion that allowed increased coordination or allowed coordination at the sort of grassroots level between the campaign and outside groups. So that loosened up this whole gray area of what's allowed between them. So yes, by law, there's no coordination between the campaign and the outside groups, but it's a little, there's a lot of fuzzy area in there.
It's kind of blatantly being violated. I think we have another caller. Thank you for checking in. Your name, your question or comment, if you like, and appreciate you checking in.
Hi, this is Brigitte from DC. Thank you so much for this conversation. I feel like you got to the heart of it just a few minutes ago, talking about race and racism. And it is important to address the inequities and the racialized impact that's negative. But I also would love to hear you talking about how it is that, for the most part, Black and brown folks have made it possible for us to make dramatic changes and turn in the right direction, and wondered what organizations or organizing formations y'all are working with to turn this around.
Virginia K. Solomon, your thoughts?
Yeah, so thank you for that question. And yeah, so Common Cause works kind of at the intersection of democracy and civil rights, and we work really closely in partnership with organizations throughout the country. And so whether it's organizations like Black Voters Matter, whether it's Unidos US, whether we are talking about grassroots organizations at the local level, the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation, the Black Women's Roundtable. I mean, I could go on and on and on, the Urban League, NAACP, Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. There are tons of groups who are working on this. And I think one of the things that I want people to walk away with knowing right now is that, you know, Black women really stood up this election. And I think Black women, I highlight Black women in particular because they have consistently been some of the biggest advocates of democracy and democratic practices in this country historically, even though we know that Black women really weren't fully enfranchised until after the Voting Rights Act was passed. And so I think one of the challenges that we have to this day is making sure that we don't discredit or disregard. I don't want people to walk away feeling hopeless from this conversation. Money doesn't always win. Money doesn't always win. Sometimes it's just about the basics. It is about good old organizing. It is about investing in grassroots groups, community organizations, who are doing the work, who are having conversations, who are going to the barbershop, the beauty salon, who are talking to their neighbors, going to churches, and understanding what people's needs are and being able to meet them where they're at and help them understand what the issues are and how they can show up and show out each election. And so thank you for that question. I think it was really an important one and one that we can't overlook.
We just have a few minutes left. Let's talk about solutions. Virginia touched on it. Brandon, what's key for you in terms of solutions to this enormous problem, which seemed to be getting worse by the day? I would imagine for people in the trenches such as yourselves, it could be a little bit discouraging. How do you get up in the morning?
Yeah. Because they can. You know, Virginia really hit on a little bit of it there, and I'll just mention some of the things that I've been involved in. And right at the federal level, now a lot has happened. And I say one thing: if we look back, the last time there was major legislation at the federal level was in 2002. They passed the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, and Virginia mentioned John McCain. It's hard to think today, right? Back then, we had McCain and Feingold in the Senate, and Shays and Meehan in the House. Democrats and Republicans got together, sponsored legislation that then passed to change the campaign finance laws significantly. It's hard to think of that happening today. But one of the things that spurred that was they had been working on it for a long time, but it was also in the post-Enron period. And that, so sometimes it takes a big event or something like we had with Enron, for those who remember that, that kind of spurs action. And then quickly on there is a lot happening at the state and local level, and people are experimenting with different things. This year in New York, they had, for the first time, they had public funding and legislative races, and they really introduced some unique aspects to try to make that work. New York City has had a program for a long time, and they're constantly tweaking it to try to keep it current and make it work. So there are things happening in Seattle. They have a voucher program. And so there's lots of things going on out there.
Virginia K. Solomon, your closing thoughts. We just have a couple of minutes because you're off to the Hill for a briefing. If you could talk about that and your ideas for how we move forward with this seemingly impossible problem.
Nothing is impossible in my mind. I think we've solved greater problems in this country in the past. I think we can do it as well. We have to create the will. I will say that I believe that there are local solutions, right? I think that this is not a top-down approach. I think we have to create the demand at the local level. So the more that we can move local reforms at this, both, you know, again, locally and at the state level, the better that we are, because we build that track record, we build that demand, we start to see these changes happen over time, and the federal government has no option but to respond. I think that's one thing. I think that we need to make sure that we are ripening the time. There's a beautiful quote by Dr. Dorothy Height, who was a founding board member of my organization. And I walk by it every single day. And she said, if the time is not ripe, we have to ripen the time. And it is our job to ripen the time in this moment. We cannot despair. We cannot look away. We know that there is no such thing as an immediate return when it comes to trying to make policy and move legislation. That rarely happens. And so this is, you know, a continuous set of, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. We just have to keep moving forward and creating that demand of our legislators. And so there are solutions. Like I said, there's the Disclose Act. There is the Freedom to Vote Act. Hopefully there will be other pieces of legislation that we can introduce and get passed at some point. I think there needs to be continued pressure around the filibuster and creating some carve outs on the filibuster or whatever it is, because it has historically blocked not only civil rights legislation, but these types of reforms. And so people continuing to reach out to your legislators, don't forget your voice actually matters. At the end of the day, they are accountable to you. And then yeah, I think that's my kind of closing remarks. And yes, I'm excited. I'll be up on the Hill today with Congressman Joe Morelli, who will be doing a briefing and just really talking about this exact issue. What can we do? What are the solutions? And there is a lot of incoming, or there's a new freshman class. Many will be there. And so it should be a great discussion.
Wonderful. We're going to have to unfortunately end it there. I've been speaking with Common Causes Virginia K. Solomon and Open Secrets Brendan Glavin. Thank you for all you're doing, and thank you both for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Take care. And on to our last guest. On February 14th, 2018, a former student gunned down 16 students and staff, excuse me, I believe 17 students and staff at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. One of the victims, Joaquin Guac Oliver, his father, co-writer and performer Manuel Oliver, managed to turn this unspeakable tragedy into a one-man show. And Guac is running January 25th through February 16th at DC's Woolly Mammoth Theater. Manuel Oliver joins us now. Thank you so much for joining us here on Community Watch and Comment.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure.
And I hope I'm not mangling the pronunciation of your name. Is it Oliver or Oliver? Or
it's fair. It's Oliver, Oliver, however you want. It's your show. You can say however you want. Don't worry.
Oh, no. I want to do it the way that you do it.
Oliver.
Very good. First of all, our condolences for your loss. I can barely imagine what that must be like, losing your dear son.
Yeah, well, it's a devastating issue that happens not only to me. I mean, it happens on a daily basis in our country. So at some point, what really matters is how we are reacting to this, right? Like,
yes.
I lost my son. Just to give you your listeners an idea, 50,000 victims ago. So for the same reason, gun violence is killing our people. We are killing each other because of our easy access to guns.
Yep. And a little context there: you're an immigrant family seeking the American dream, if you will, and then you're confronted with this slaughter.
Yeah. Well, in our case, it's and back to the American dream concept. Like, we moved from Venezuela, we 21 years ago, looking for a safer and better future for our kids. We did our homework. We really did our homework. We did everything by the book. And then suddenly injustice is just part of our system. It's a part of our system that could be preventable. Otherwise, I wouldn't be fighting so hard. It's not an exception. It's not a one event that it will never happen again. No, it's a permanent thing that is hitting us. And yeah, there it goes. That American dream. It vanished in front of our eyes. And now we live here. We stay here. We are not planning to go anywhere because this is where my son's fight will take place.
Yes. Yes. And how did you manage to turn your grief into this performance, which you're taking it around the country, yes?
I am taking it around the country, and I'm not replacing the grief. The grief stays there, okay? There's no way. I wish there was some way of changing grief into something different. You could add stuff. You could add actions. You could add moments of relief. You can add moments of happiness and moments of joy, but miserable thought of losing a loved one, in my case, my beautiful son, my best friend, my movie partner, my everything, it's going to be there forever. And I don't want anyone to remove it, you know? I like to carry my pain because I'm Joaquin's father. I'm not the victim here. The victim is my son, and I'm a father, and I want to still be a father. I think I have the right to still be a father and do things for my son. Now I had to do it in a different way, and theater is exactly that. It's allowing me to continue protecting my kid, talking about my kid, feel proud of my kid, and sharing all those thoughts with as many people as I can.
Yeah. So it's the performance is not a, it's not a, it's not a funeral, if you will. There's joy. There's a comedic aspect, and it's a call to action.
There's plenty of joy. You know what? And I don't want, the reason for that is that I don't want, it's unfair with Joaquin to remind him for his last 2 minutes in life. I think that Joaquin has a lot of stories to share, those amazing 17 years, full of happiness, full of joy, full of dreams, goals, plans, family trips. And the way that we were able to place a story takes all that information and make it a beautiful moment where people will laugh. And of course, we go through the aspect of the gun violence issue. But I guess that's not the center of the play. The center of the play is how can we protect life? How can I, as a father, my wife, as a mother, have an opportunity to let you guys know Joaquin better? Because we're all missing him. And it's not fair for you guys not to get to know him, because I met him, but you guys didn't.
Right. And we're running out of time, just a minute or two left. You've got a related school bus effort. I guess if you could talk about that,
easy.
That aspect.
We were traveling with the play. It required more travel. And we said, you know what? Well, if we're going to travel, we're going to travel the good way. That doesn't mean a nice seat on an airplane. No, let's purchase a school bus. Let's make a statement everywhere we go. So that's what we did a few years ago. We bought a school bus for $9,000. And we upgraded that thing in a level where you can work inside that school bus. You can have a pop-up rally. We have speakers, a great sound system, an office space inside, and of course, a lot of Joaquin information. We have digital billboards on one of each side of the school bus. It's a combination between a rally, a party, and a moving device that is bringing change to every single community that we visit.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. The dates again. The date, the particular dates that you're got all kinds of performances, but the dates that Woolly Mammoths of your play. It's not really a play; it's a performance of Guac.
January 25th, all the way to February 16th. And I have to remind everyone that on February 14th, which is actually the anniversary of the shooting, that terrible day that marked my life, we will be performing that night. So there's no better way to remember and honor our son than being on stage in DC, a few blocks away from the Capitol building and a few blocks away from the White House, where decisions need to be made to make sure right. that we are safer.
We're going to have to end it there. I've been speaking with performer and co-writer Manuel Oliver. Thank you so much.
Thank
for
you.
Today. Really
thank you very much.
It. That's going to do it for our show. Thanks to the amazing Mike Nocella for pulling us through, coming up the headlines, followed by Don't Forget the Blues with the amazing Lady Murr. I appreciate you joining us today. Be well, stay warm, and have a good week.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at WPFWFM.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world one broadcast at a time.
We're back! WPFW is excited to announce the return of the Social Justice Calendar, your go-to weekly update on the latest events, actions, and initiatives promoting equity, justice, and change across our community. The calendar's mission is to connect you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Each week, we'll spotlight rallies, workshops, forums, and community actions happening across the region. If you have an event to share, submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of said event in a format that is no longer than a sentence or two on Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, at least 2 weeks in advance of your event date. Space is limited, so submissions are considered in the order that they are received. The Social Justice Calendar is yet another way that WPFW connects, engages, and uplifts our community as we build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Sego, this is John Kane, and I want to invite you to join me right here on WPFW on Fridays at 2 p.m. for Let's Talk Native. I will deliver guests and commentary each week on the real-life issues facing Native people. No romanticizing and no Hollywood stereotypes here. We'll talk real history and culture and life as it is and as it should be. Our shows are available as podcasts on your favorite podcast platforms and as videos on our Let's Talk Native TV YouTube channel. Find links and more at our website, www.letstalknative.com. And I'll see you here Fridays at 2 p.m. for Let's Talk Native with John Kane.
Still, it's a real good bet, the best is yet to come.
Hi, this is Robin Holden, the proprietor of Robin's Place. Every Friday evening from 7 until 10 p.m., Robin's Place is a mythical entertainment center consisting of four floors. On each floor of Robin's Place, we have rooms that are named after people who I think are icons in music, theater, and literature. We have the Nancy Wilson Room, the Joe Williams Room, the Gloria Lynn Room, the Frank Sinatra Room, the B.B. King Blues Room, the James Baldwin Library, just to name a few. Join me Friday nights from 7 until 10 p.m. as I take you on a musical journey you'll never forget. Robin's Place.
Come the day you're mine, I'm gonna teach you to fly.
The great jazz master Sonny Rollins always says, music is an open sky. This is Willard Jenkins inviting you to join me for my new WPFW show, Open Sky, Sunday afternoons from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. We'll explore great jazz classics, including many from the beloved Great American Songbook, during our first hour. And then, 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. will be my traditional What's New, the new release hour, as we check out what today's contemporary artists are up to with a raft of new releases. That's Open Sky,